You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Well, listener, thank you for tuning in to the second half of a very, very long episode about C.S. Lewis's book, That Hideous Strength, the third book in his space trilogy. This episode is co-hosted by me, David Grubbs, and Jordan Poss. We're picking up in the conversation with David telling us about the attempt of NICE, the villainous institution in the book, to bring Mark over to their side.
I was really fascinated by the scene in one of the scenes in which he's being initiated, that kind of systematic degradation and violation of taboos and whatnot. The culminating taboo is to tread on a crucifix and curse the name of Christ. All right. Which Mark, who has no religious background whatsoever, but has had his sort of moral senses through this initiation, it's supposed to be tearing him down morally. It's actually building him up. He is learning as he goes why the taboos that are being violated ought to be upheld. There's this resistance in him. It's like when you rub iron against iron, and slowly it becomes magnetic. Right? They're trying to break him down, but they're actually building him up. And so when he comes to this cross, he has no Christian dogma to draw on. He believes that there was this historical man who died on a cross, that he'd said a bunch of stuff but found out he was wrong. So there's no supernatural element to it, but it's almost as if the kind of departure from a Christian orthodoxy in which Christ is God and his death on the cross is atoning and redeeming, and then to diminish that into, well, Christ was, God in a more kind of soft focus way. and redemption is something that means something more like moral awakening. And then Jesus is just a really good teacher who was executed before, resistance in kind of a general way. Like, we see that as kind of this departure from Christian truth. But he's almost coming at it from the other way, where suddenly the cross becomes something to take serious because he's like, because he says the bentness of NICE hates this cross. Might there be something in it? Might it be more powerfully aligned with what is with the straight and the good that I'm learning to love? Might this cross be more powerfully aligned with it, and the one on that cross be powerfully aligned with it than I'd thought, given the way in which NICE opposes it? It's almost as if he is learning his friends by knowing his enemies. it's an interesting movement, which I found really fascinating, especially historically, in the Shogunate era Japan, after the rise of the Tokugawa Shogunate and the Shogunate's attempt to suppress Christianity. One of the systematic ways that they attempted to do this was wherever there was a village or a community where there was rumored to be Christians, the government would descend, and they had these images of the Virgin Mary and of the crucifix that the government had made explicitly so that everyone who was accused of being a Christian or who was part of this rumored to be Christian community would have to step on the image and deny Christ. You know, they were called...
So how did they root out the Calvinists?
Well, they didn't have any of those, because the missionaries who went to Japan were Jesuits. Or maybe Franciscans? Maybe both? I can't...
Definitely Jesuits. I can't remember if there are any Franciscans.
Yeah.
I feel like there's an easy out there that, you know, you just need the good iconoclast to come through and be like, yeah, I'll smash that. Sure.
Well, they didn't have any of those, so, you know, but they were called stepping on images. You know, the Japanese translation of the term was stepping on images. And so, you know, when Lewis pulls this in, this is something that has happened in the history of, you know, of world government attempts to suppress Christianity.
Yeah. I thought of Silence, the novel.
Yes.
Reading that passage, which, you know, Silence was, you know, was it Shusaku Endo? And that was published in the 60s, I think. I can't remember the precise publication, but he talks about that, and that's some of the climactic action of the book is those stepping on images. A very similar dialogue actually takes place. I was very struck by it, where you know, in both Silence and in That Hideous Strength, when Mark, and in that case, is it Rodriguez, the missionary, presented with this, you know, they're kind of told, this is just a formality. You know, you just step on it. It's not a big deal. Mm-hmm. Go forward with it. And it's like, well, if this is not that big of a deal, why are you going to kill me if I don't? And that kind of gives the game away. And for Mark, that sort of awakens in him an understanding of, because of the very carefully done progression, you know, the disgust with himself, fueled by the way he toadies to the people in Nice, gradually kind of what Nice does is for Mark is they draw his attention to things that he would otherwise be tempted to dismiss, and that forces him to take them more seriously because of the importance they place on them. And that you're right, that is what, like, really interesting, is kind of his kind of the climactic moment of his moral movement through the book.
And it may just be that my sensibilities have been so shaped by Protestantism that I definitely found myself thinking, yeah, I'll smash your idol, but I'm not going to curse Christ. So
yeah.
I can balance this in good conscience perfectly.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the same thing is going on with Jane at St. Anne's, except
the idol smashing.
Right, except the idol smashing. But what's going on with Mark is a gradual realignment to the good that grows out of a repugnance to the manifest evil, right? First in, you know, an awareness of it in the others around him at Nice, but then a growing awareness of it within himself, right? So it's a kind of repentance at this vision of sin, much like Dante taking a tour through Inferno, really.
Right.
But then for Jane is being wooed, right? She sees all of these people who she regards as beautiful, as lovely, as possessed of not just a kind of strict, morally correct, unhappy virtue, but a happy virtue, a laughing virtue. This is the kind of thing that pre-conversion Lewis saw in Chesterton and George MacDonald and loved it, even while he could not rationally persuade himself to see the world that way. He loved what the effect of seeing the world that way was in those people. And so Jane, who is always kind of rejected Christianity and traditional morality and all of those sorts of things, she is struck by the winsomeness of the people of St. Anne. So it's another kind of force. It's a wooing of good on her side, while on Mark, it is a gradual kind of rejection of evil.
Right. And combined for Jane, at least, with the emptiness of her older worldview, older life. Yeah. I mean, the first couple of pages of the book could be right out of The Feminine Mystique, right? Jane is this stay-at-home wife who has her own academic interests, but is basically deeply discontent with the everything that she has that she should be enjoying, that the world is telling her she should be enjoying. You know, she's a liberated woman. She's she is at least theoretically not just the wife at home. She is doing everything that a woman in the world ought to be doing, and she's miserable. And then of course she gets tortured too. So there's that. And then the vision of the good on as the alternative to both the cruelty of this world that Mark is sinking into, and then the emptiness of the world that she was in before all of this started.
Yeah. I was gonna say it didn't occur to me until you put it in the image of idols being smashed for Mark, but I think Jane does have some idols smashed, but they're all interior.
Sure.
They're all internal to her. Yep. And that's those false images that she has had of what her role is as a wife, as an academic, as a, you know, a woman in the world, you know, the kind of, you know, atomized, autonomous individual. Because what she finds, what Mark is looking for and at Nice, and what Jane finds at St. Anne's almost accidentally is community. And the differences between those two communities are one of the more striking aspects of the novel.
Yeah, and I guess we should talk about the four things I have left, that if we get to all of them, we're going to be here for 3 hours. But I think we can hit two at once if we just lump them under community. The book's view of marriage and the book's view of the inner circle. What did you guys think about those? I mean, if you have any kind of progressive view of marriage, you're going to just throw this book away.
Yeah. I don't know if I have any serious thoughts about it, but I was aware as I was reading it of the kinds of people who would hate it. you know, that didn't really affect my reading or my agreement or disagreement with it, but I thought that using it specifically for this plot and specifically for the characters of Mark and Jane and the world in which they live, I thought it was very well done. And again, it's what we're seeing in the plot of this book and in the development of their relationship and their marriage and the healing of some wounds at the end is just the beginning of what they are meant for. Right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they, Ransom, you know, Lewis, presumably speaking through Ransom, directly ties love and marriage to obedience for Jane. Mm-hmm. Mark doesn't have that same sort of guidance, but by the end of the book, we can see that he has come to the realization that he needs to directly tie love to self-sacrifice.
Yeah.
He needs to be willing to give up himself and all of the things he desired for what is good for Jane.
Yes.
Yeah. Again, I think that's not something that's going to, you know, sell a lot of books these days outside of, you know, traditional evangelical and maybe Roman Catholic circles.
Yeah. Well, the person I had in mind earlier, just doing a little bit of background research, the one person I know of who this is his favorite C.S. Lewis book is Doug Wilson.
Oh, of course it is. Is there any more infuriating person on the internet than Doug Wilson?
I don't follow him closely enough to have an opinion. I am aware of his reputation. So as soon as I saw that, I was like, oh.
Well, there you go.
That makes sense.
Yep. Yeah, I'm friends with him on Goodreads, and he loves... I forget if this is the one he's like, I reread this every other year or something like that. And I'm like,
I ran across an interview he was doing with the author of a really good book about C.S. Lewis, a guy named Joe Rigney, and they were talking about various Lewis topics, and they had a specific – you can find it on YouTube. It's like a specific 8 or 9 minute discussion of That Hideous Strength, and I think he says something to that effect.
Yeah, the Rigney book is the
– C.S. Lewis on
the Christian C.S. Lewis Life. On the Christian Life. All of those books are fantastic, mm-hmm. but that one is especially good. The Augustine one is the best one so far. But that Lewis book is really, really worth picking up. This inner circle stuff, you guys have anything to say about that? I understand the temptation there. I'm enough of sort of a narcissist to not be really attracted by that. Like, I don't really care what other people think, and if I'm not on the inside, it's probably because the inside's dumb anyway. Yeah. So,
the outside inside.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who wants to be in there? Those people are lame.
I think I tend to agree. I don't like cliques or, you know, the inner ring or the inner circle. And I actually just this afternoon reread Lewis's it's an essay or a public address that he gave called The Inner Ring. And I think it's from about this time period as well. So it's, again, one of those things that's clearly on his mind and popping up in multiple works at the same time. But it's an address in which he cautions a group, I believe, of students to be on the lookout, not for inner circles per se. Because he says that, you know, those kinds of relationships are unavoidable. It's essentially what a family is. Any organization that is sufficiently complex is going to have smaller groups of people who all work together and you commune together. What he cautions
grad students.
Yeah. I went to Clemson 2.5 years and I didn't hang out with any undergrads. I wasn't being a snob, right? I was just part of my the circle I wound up in organically. And I think the word organic is key there, because in that essay he cautions people against actively striving for places deeper and deeper in those rings or in those circles. He says, you know, if you're ever and you see this over and over again with Mark, is the temptation, to put it crudely, to prostitute yourself for positions of greater and greater, not even necessarily influence, but just the feeling that you're on the inside, right? That you are part of the establishment, that you're part of that clique that runs things, that, you know, that you are part of a we that is specifically exclusionary, right? So that you're part of the you know, those of us who really know what's going on, the you know, the kind of knowing effect there, which is what NICE is all about, right? It's only, again, we only get a couple of examples of what it is that NICE is actually up to, but we know it involves a certain amount of human experimentation, probably some eugenics stuff. I think they invoked eugenics a couple of times, vivisection, and, you know, really cruel experiments on animals. And I'm sure if this had come out after the atomic bomb, nuclear research would go in there as well. As opposed to, you know, we only get a little bit of a glimpse of what they're actually up to. It's mostly about office politics and the drama that goes along with that. And on the other hand, the very organic relationships of the people at St. Anne's, where there are people who have just kind of come together and they relate to each other in a organic, meaningful way that is natural to who they are as people, so that everybody has a role, everybody has a function, and they're not all climbing over each other to be closer to ransom or whatever.
Right, and it's not a, you know, it's not a patriarchy, contrary to Doug Wilson.
Yes.
Right, they all take turns doing the dishes and cooking, and everyone kind of dreads when it's the men's turn cooking, but they do take turns doing it, and. They all work in the garden, and they all, you know, pet the bear, and they all do, you know, the various things. Anything else on inner circle or marriage? Otherwise, we'll move on to the atomic bomb.
Yeah.
Seems appropriate. All right, from marriage, go ahead, David.
With the marriage thing, I think it's fascinating that as the last thoughts that we get of Mark before he arrives at St. Anne's at the end of the book, we never actually get to see their reunion, right? We just see them both taking steps toward this chamber that represents that.
And the Barry White comes on.
Yes.
Yes. Stops before consummation. Yes.
Yes. It does not ever actually get to that point. Like, it goes hazy. It goes soft focus. Ellipses.
So let's hope HBO never makes this into a series. Because
never ever.
Because then you'd also get the elephants and Mr. Bultitude and Mrs. Bultitude and.
The mice in the walls.
Yeah.
But one of the last things that Mark is thinking as he approaches St. Anne's is that he has already failed Jane permanently, that he has never taken her seriously, that he has never seriously pursued her, that he had always seen himself as in some sense owning her, or at least having kind of a free license with regard to her, and the courtly view of the knight as servant of the lady is something that he's discovering as he comes up to St. Anne's, that there was a highness and a holiness that ought to have been in that relationship, which was not there. He simply wanted someone who admired him to have sex with. Right? That was the extent of his need. And so he the last thoughts we see as he walks to St. Anne's is his he's basically the prodigal son at this point. Mm-hmm. His intention, as soon as he sees her, is to offer her a divorce. Because he doesn't think their relationship can go anywhere positive. Because he screwed it up. He's such a screw-up. And that I think, is really fascinating in Lewis. That Mark does not have any kind of intention of repentance or any kind of, you know, resolve to be better. As far as he's concerned, his repentance has led himself to see their relationship as unredeemable because he has so badly botched it. That I think is a fascinating view from his side. Hmm. The inner circle stuff. One of the things that Lewis does is it shows us the way that the social politics and dynamics of that. First academic and then later a kind of corporate organizational life effaces the real world nature of the work that they do and the effects of that work on other real people outside of the organization. There's a scene in which Mark is laughing with those around him about this scheme that they're going to put into effect, and he can join in their laughter because he's inside, right? But the effect of what they're going to do is actually going to be there's going to be a body count. But they're laughing about it because within the organization it means a victory for the organization. And so one of the things that sort of late post World War II meditations on. Particularly life inside of Nazi Germany. Was the ways that ordinary people with desk jobs were led into becoming the cogs of this massively monstrous wheel.
Right.
How did the very mundanity of their engagement with the Nazi regime lead them to not see what they were doing? I find it fascinating that this novel is being written so during and so soon after that, that there's already this kind of parallel that we could get there organizationally. There's mm-hmm. there's a distance that being in the inner circle puts you from those who experience the direct effect of your work that is genuinely dangerous,
yeah.
Socially.
Hmm. I'm glad you brought that point up about the Nazis, because, I mean, World War II is winding down, and I can't remember precisely what he says, but he says, you know, the scene is the small college a few years after the war. And that struck me because, yes. Again, you know, when he writes Perelandra, it's still a lot more up in the air. Here, clearly, he is writing during the war but can prognosticate a time after the war in which the Nazis aren't around anymore.
Yeah.
So it's clear who's going to win at this point. Yeah. And that sort of is important because rather than, you know, a speculative post-war novel in which, you know, Heinrich Himmler has a SS Gruppenführer who is now running Britain, the danger is from within. Right. And so,
yes.
So, what's that? There's that moment as well when Dimble, who doesn't get a ton of time in the novel, but Dimble has that passage where he begins to meditate and realizes that there's a potential Bellbury inside him as well. So, I mean, the dichotomy between the two sides is not as clear cut as it might at first seem. You know, that there is a continuous war within each of the people at St. Anne's to stay true. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. That was an interesting interesting insight that got my mind turning over again.
Well, Jordan, you wanted to talk about the atomic bomb, so I'll let you drop that one.
Ha ha.
Nice.
I avoided the Nazi not seeing pun, but that was an even bigger bomb. So I was just curious. This we don't have to answer in any amount of detail, but I was just struck by the timing of the novel, and especially since Lewis did express thoughts later, especially in a very good address or essay called "On Living in an Atomic Age," which is really great if y'all haven't read it. He definitely had thoughts about the atomic bomb, and as did Tolkien, who again basically thought that it was the Allies who were on the side of right, adopting the worst of the methods of the enemy in order to defeat the enemy. I'm just curious what y'all think this novel might look like if it had been written even 6 months later. Like, what does Nice — Coyle, you already kind of said this, but what does Nice look like? What are their goals, and how are they approaching their problems if they've got atomic bombs at their disposal?
I mean, I don't know that it necessarily would have looked that different. Mm-hmm. In part because I think by the time — and Jordan, you know the history here 100 times better than I do — but my understanding is that by the time the atomic bomb actually drops, it's not really a surprise to anyone who's kind of following the academic world. Like, they've known about atomic power for a while. There's some questions about whether it's going to, blow up the whole Earth, right, or just the one little part of it that we want to. But the fact that can be done, if Lewis had wanted to write that in, he probably could have.
Yeah, it's possible.
So and of course, it wouldn't — part of what he does, and we haven't talked about a whole lot of this, but this Nice is not just a sinister organization. I mean, it is just a sinister organization, but it's also this coordinated national thing that's got the government and the press and the common people all kind of on board. And that's a harder sell if you're like, yeah, we're going to build bigger bombs.
Right.
Like, they wouldn't phrase it like that. They'd wrap it in bureaucratic language, more efficient means of ending conflict or something. But I don't know that it really would have changed all that much had he done that. And I think he probably could have done it if he really wanted to. I think he wasn't interested in that. Just like he's not — I mean, he tells us they're doing vivisection and human experimentation and all that. He never actually tells us what they're doing.
Right, yeah.
And that's he doesn't care.
Yeah, I was —
right? I mean, that's not what he's —
oh, yeah. To your point, when the animals that have been loosed from the laboratories by Merlin all show up at the end, I've forgotten about the vivisection by that point. And so I had to kind of remind myself. I was like, oh, yeah, they've got all these animals they're experimenting on. Because you do see such a limited sliver of what it is that the Nice is up to. And it is — I think it's pretty apparent that they've got laboratories elsewhere.
So maybe they are working on atomic bombs somewhere.
Yeah, it's possible. Yeah, my understanding is that, maybe for a small inner ring of people with knowledge of physics, I think the surprise of the atomic bomb was with the speed with which what was theoretical became actual. And again, even within the upper reaches of the Allied high command and the American government. I mean, Harry Truman did not know about the Manhattan Project until he actually became president. The actuality of it is a closely guarded secret, even if the theoretical possibilities are not. I think that's a good point. And in On Living in an Atomic Age, Lewis tries to tackle the question, for people who are anxious about the new terrible weapons that have debuted, how do we live differently now? And he says, well, what is different? How have things changed? He basically says 100% of people still die. Not that much has changed. If anything, it might just be more — if anything, it might just be more instantaneous and less painful.
Right. In the episode that CHB did a long time ago about Tolkien, there were some questions about, some people read the Ring as an allegory of atomic power or whatever. There were a lot of people in the 70s that wanted to do that, which Tolkien rejected, first because, of Tolkien's feelings about allegory, and second because he wrote the book you know, he drafted much of the book that they were responding to before the bomb was dropped, and he didn't know about the bomb. But the thing is, he did know about mustard gas.
Right.
Yes. And he knew about tanks, and he knew about massive firebombings.
Yeah, like carpet bombing was a thing.
Right. Yeah, so, you know, from First World War and Second World War, he knew about weapons of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. That was a thing. And even though we don't have atomic bombs in that hideous strength, we do have the machine gun fire.
Right. Yes, yeah.
That scene of the machine gun probably doesn't feel the same way to us now. When I'm reading that scene, I'm superimposing all of the late 20th, early 21st century sort of mass civilian shootings. But the sound of a machine gun in England at that point, and especially for someone who had been in World War I, that is a sound. That is a war sound.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So the atomic bomb isn't in there, but that the idea that NICE is bringing modern mechanized warfare and using it as a tool for subjugating their own populace, that's in there.
Yeah, and they feel it's justified for strictly pragmatic ends. They don't make the, you know, you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs argument, but they say everything but that.
Right. Mm. Stalin hadn't said that yet, right?
Or whoever said it.
David, since you, before we move on to the last two questions that I have for you guys, David, since you referenced the CHP episode on Tolkien, I want you to know that since we recorded the episode on Perelandra, and out of respect for Michael Farmer, I've been trying to find a way to call this Lewis's version of the Silmarillion.
Nice.
I've been working so hard to find a way to fit that in somehow.
Well, it does have Numenor in it.
It does, and it is long, and yeah. I like Tolkien. Silmarillion I struggle with.
Tolkien in his letters said that he thinks he called Lewis's inclusion of Numenor here plagiarism, and then he walked it back a little bit. I think he was being jocular, and he said it's spelled differently because Lewis had only ever heard him say it in meetings.
That
and
I find
things.
So interesting.
Yeah, which
that's so interesting.
And what Lewis has done, an aspect of the reception history of this I'm really interested in. What would people in 1945 have made of references to Numenor? Because the Silmarillion is still over 30 years away. Like, right. Lewis has written fan fiction for fiction that doesn't exist yet.
Well, The Lord of the Rings hasn't even been published yet.
Right.
Like, yeah. It's not for another, I don't know, what, 5, 6, 7 years?
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Yeah, it's a few years down the road.
50, I can't remember. 50-something.
Yeah, it's like he's giving a teaser for his buddy's book.
Nobody knows about Numenor. Like,
right.
Isn't that fascinating? Well, this is the first that anybody knew about Numenor.
Right.
Gosh.
Maybe Tolkien stole it from Lewis. I mean,
no.
How can you prove that he didn't? Lewis published first.
But it does let us see that Numenor was much more clearly for Tolkien, and at least in Lewis's informal inklings reception of Tolkien, that Numenor was just Atlantis.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That it was just another name for Atlantis, because there's no distinction between the way Lewis talks about it here. There's nothing Middle Earthy in the way that he's using it here. It's just this lost antediluvian world of magic. It reminds me more of the function of Atlantis in Robert Howard's Conan stories than it does the Numenor of Tolkien.
Right. Oh, well, since we're mentioning magic, just two possibly quick, hopefully quick, closing questions, since we're coming up on 2 hours. This may end up being split in half. We'll have to see. And I'm especially interested with you guys as medievalists. What do you think about this as an Arthur story?
There are some parts of this that I really love as Arthur. There's a the scene when the various planetary intelligences come to St. Anne's, and the Oyarsa of Mars shows up, Melisandre himself. And there's this one little moment where you get where you have Merlin remembering Baden Hill.
Yes.
As lined Romano-British cataphracts. Like, that is rad.
That was awesome.
All the things that we've been saying about this novel, dear listeners, there were actually multiple times when I was reading this novel when I was like this close to crying. But there's just something about that moment of Baden Hill that was like, ah, I knew exactly what they meant because of what that means within Arthurian literature. That kind of desperate last stand that somehow becomes a victory. That's in there. I'm fascinated by that. Arthur's alive, but he's on Venus. That's a little weird.
Yeah.
It reminds me of a couple of things of the role that the Arthur story was played in with the pre-Raphaelites and then with some early 19th century or early 20th century authors. In particular, Arthur Machen. Arthur Machen was an Irish author, best known for some kind of weird horror that Lovecraft enjoyed. But he also wrote a rather longish story about the Holy Grail appearing in a village in Wales, and the way that it transforms the community. I have a very hard time imagining that Lewis had not read and been influenced by that story by Arthur Machen, because the way that St. Anne's works is the way that this little village in Wales works when the Grail is present. So there's definitely some things that Lewis's read the sources. He's also interested in a historical Arthur, but also what he's doing with Arthur is in tune with some of the reception of Arthurian stuff among Victorians and Edwardians.
I'll try to be quick. I'll say this very bluntly, and then I'll walk it back. The Arthur stuff did not work for me in this book. By the end, I was reading the book and simultaneously trying to imagine what the book would look like without it. Because if Orwell thought the devil stuff was intrusive, I actually thought the Arthur stuff did, I'm guessing this is where Tolkien's misgivings came from. There's no Arthur stuff in Out of the Silent Planet or Perelandra. And then, you know, what starts off feeling like a fairly organic continuation of those themes suddenly gets all like Alfred Lord Tennyson. You know, this stuff, it does feel kind of injected. That said, I love Merlin in this book. Again, he's not the kind of daft old coot with the beard. He is actually an impressive, powerful figure, which I really, really like. He's one of the most compelling characters in the book, and I kind of wish Lewis had just written an Arthur book so we could have gotten that unmixed with, you know, college politics and dystopia and that kind of thing. So you know, take it back to Orwell. I just thought the elements, all the ingredients are great and they don't mix, right? Right. That's the Baden Hill thing was awesome, even if my ancestors were on the other side.
Wrong side of history.
I know.
Jordan.
I'm of history.
Hey, yeah, we are speaking my ancestors' language, so. You can tell me which side you think is the right one. But it has moments here and there, but I just thought when I'm with the Arthur stuff, I'm like, this is great. Then when we go back to something else, it took me out of the story. So that's I don't know, it did not work as a cohesive whole for me, even though I thought the individual parts were good. And Merlin was awesome, even if I could see a version of this novel that didn't need him.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that's fair. It's the whole novel kind of felt like all of Lewis's other works smashed down into one.
Exactly.
both future and past and fiction and nonfiction. Yes.
I went for a walk before this and had the same thought. I thought, this is the most Lewis-y novel Lewis ever wrote, because all of the things he cares about are in it. And again, like you said, fiction and nonfiction.
And it, again, I think as a result, it ends up being both long and heavy-handed and both more complicated than it needed to be and way too much conversation. But again, that's a... I'm on the I still don't think it's great side, even though I think it's better than I did, you know, 2 weeks ago. Last question, and then we'll end with some reading suggestions. What do you guys think? What is that hideous strength?
You mean? Like,
I mean, they tell us they're fighting it over and over, but I don't know if they ever specifically say it is. Like, is it the attraction of Nice? Is it the awful stuff that Nice is going to do? Is it just the devil? I mean, what are we supposed to assume?
It was in the thingamy, the epigraph.
Mm-hmm. My take was that, because the epigraph refers to the Tower of Babel, right?
Yes.
I don't have an epigraph in my version.
Yeah, I don't.
That hideous strength, sex mile and more, it is of length.
Mine is on the title page, bizarrely.
Yeah.
Oh, hey, there it is.
Yeah. So, I took it as go ahead, David.
Yeah, Babel.
Yeah. Go. And the same what overweening hubris looks like at Babel is trying to build a tower. What that looks like in Lewis's age is what Nice does. So
see, there's a passage where I think he's talking to Merlin, and they're like going. Merlin's like, "Well, let's just go over and cut off all their heads,
yeah,
and
great.
Then let's go talk to the king." And then it's sort of the Council of Elrond, but for the book and at the end, and not as good. But it is interesting. And at one point, Ransom says, "Look, we're facing that hideous strength, so we can't do any of that stuff." And then I was like, "Okay, why? Like, what is this?" But if it's in the epigraph, I just missed it. So, because I apparently didn't read the title page, rookie freshman mistake right there.
There's a lot going on in that Babel reference, and it has a lot to do with.
Right.
The many things that Babel has meant, not just the function that it serves in the scriptures of showing this one moment of human hubris, in which a united, what does the C stand for?
Coordinated.
In which a united humanity is able to break the boundaries that God has imposed upon them. So there's that in the Bible, and then there's the confusion of the languages is how Merlin breaks up the nice party at the end,
which I really enjoyed.
There's also though in the sort of patristic and before that sort of Jewish rabbinic tradition of dealing with Genesis. Is that Nimrod is the character of Nimrod is always associated with the building of Babel, and Nimrod in the Vulgate is considered a giant. So Babel was almost like Genesis 6 Nephilim rebel angels round 2 in some of the patristic and rabbinic treatments of Babel. So this idea that it's not just Nice as human hubris, it's human hubris that is supplemented by an ultimate demonic hubris. That's an attempt to secure Earth from the wrath of heaven.
Hmm.
And that's literally the plot.
Yeah.
It's not even an allegory.
Right.
Right. Yeah, the head is animated by the devil. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and again, in that passage where Ransom is talking to Merlin, Ransom says, basically, the only way we can beat this is for these other spirits, governing angels, to come down and save us. And more specifically, Merlin, to possess you and go out and confuse the language and then unleash the animals who will then trample and kill everyone in Nice and then blow the place up. Which, sort of like the fist fight in Paralandra, had to have been somewhat satisfying to write for Lewis.
Oh, man. I found all the bear eatings, you know. I'm like...
Elephant trampling.
I was here for it.
Yeah. Yep. If the book had been 150 pages shorter and still ended with that, I'd be on board.
Yeah.
I'd be sold on this.
And then the earth swallows Edgestowe. And I love me a good surrealist cataclysm at the end of a book. So
yes.
Well, anything else? Otherwise, we'll end with some book recommendations. What? Anything else on the book?
I feel like there's always more, but I think we probably said out.
Sure.
This is.
Yeah, it's a 400-page book.
We haven't touched like fairies or really gotten into the god intelligences or there's just so much.
Or fairy hardcastle.
Yeah.
This is completely left.
Yeah, all of that. Yeah. Divine from Out of the Silent Planet comes back. I mean, there's a lot more going on. I guess if we say anything else about it, it's just if you haven't read it, you should.
Well, if you have read it, what else should people read? What do you guys have for reading instructions, reading suggestions? Jordan, you want to start us off?
Yeah, I would point you toward George Orwell's review, which I think is instructive, and I think his criticisms are mostly fair. But I'm a George Orwell fanboy, so I mean, you know, I think, like I said, I have different misgivings, but I think he's more or less on the right track. I also want to mention that because as I was reading this, I was really reminded, especially at the end when all the members of St. Anne's are sitting around in these weird ceremonial robes, I was very strongly reminded of The Man Who Was Thursday by Chesterton.
Yeah.
Just the curious, more real than real kind of surrealist fantasy of it. And then I read Orwell's review and he says, this reminds me a lot of The Man Who Was Thursday. So that was gratifying. And you know, if George Orwell is thinking of it, I think that's worth pursuing. So I would recommend reading The Man Who Was Thursday, which is a dramatically different novel. It is much faster paced. It is literally a chase, chasing the entire book. But I think is doing some very similar things. From Lewis's other work, The Abolition of Man, which I just listened to. It's like an hour and a half long in audiobook. If you want to just listen to it, I was also meaning to reread it, but who has time right now? Because again, this book is an explicit dramatization of the ideas there, particularly, and we didn't even touch on the effects of education, right? Because he makes it quite clear that part of the problem with Mark is that he has never been taught to love the right things, and The Abolition of Man touches on that a lot. The essay, The Inner Ring from The Weight of Glory, the essay, The Humanitarian Theory of Punishment from God in the Dock, which touches on themes that come up several times in this book, The Poison of Subjectivism in Christian Reflections, and then On Living in an Atomic Age and The Funeral of a Great Myth, which I've mentioned. And there's also a fragmentary response to his critic, J.B.S. Haldane, the Marxist dialectical materialist critic of That Hideous Strength. He never finished it or published it, but it's called a Reply to Professor Haldane, and it's in a couple of his books, but the one I have it in is On Stories. All of those would be worth looking at. And if you don't want to take the time to read it, there is a great YouTube channel called C.S. Lewis Doodle, D-O-O-D-L-E, where you get an audiobook narration of one of these essays along with somebody doing like chalk drawings that go along with it, and it is great. Check it out.
Well, I will recommend again if you like the space trilogy, and there is much to like about it. There is also a fragment of a fourth book called The Dark Tower. I think I've mentioned this before. It's collected in a book that's just called The Dark Tower and Other Stories by C.S. Lewis. Of that, it's like a 200-page book. It's pretty short. The Dark Tower fragment is is about the first 100 pages or so. And it's what if Ransom were interested in time travel is kind of the premise there. Yeah, it's interesting, and I actually am kind of sad he didn't get to finish it, because it, I think, is the one that shows the most promise, and it's the one that's unfinished. Michael Ward has a book called Planet Narnia, where he tries to systematize the Chronicles of Narnia, but especially the last section of that Hideous Strength, where you have the various planets descending, fits in really well. He draws on that, so it's worth reading kind of alongside Lewis's fiction. I'm blanking on his first name. Harry Poe, and I think his middle name is Lee, yeah. Although I almost said Lewis because we're talking about Lewis. Is coming out with a trilogy of a C.S. Lewis biography in trilogy form. The first book is now out, and it is excellent. It's called Becoming C.S. Lewis or Young Man Lewis or something like that. I don't remember the exact title. I'll throw a link to it in the show notes. It's really, really good. It's been nominated for all sorts of book awards, and I'll be surprised if it doesn't win a bunch of them. In terms of wrestling kind of with the substance of what Michael and especially Jane are dealing with in this book, especially that question of interacting with other people in community, but still wanting to sort of hold on to all of these modern ideals, but then kind of feeling empty because of all of that. Francis Schaeffer is writing in the wake of all of this. So he starts writing in the 50s. His books address that specific topic much more directly than C.S. Lewis's nonfiction writings do. Kind of in that Hideous Strength, we get more of a direct response. But Schaeffer's books, especially his trilogy and True Spirituality, are engaging the same ideas and the same sort of cultural movements on the personal level. David, what do you got? What do you recommend that people pick up and read?
I'm approaching this from the literary standpoint. So some Charles Williams may be helpful. I don't have any particular recommendations there, because that's one inkling that I just have not spent that much time with. So I'm just going to say there's probably some Charles Williams that's relevant. That Arthur Machen story about the Holy Grail, I can't remember the title off the top of my head, but Arthur Machen also wrote a couple of stories, one called The Great God Pan, another one called The White People, not white people, but like white people. Both of which have this idea of the world having this darker spiritual side that modernity has effaced, and that is that much more dangerous because our worldviews do not have room for it. So that idea is something that I think Lewis is getting a lot of mileage out of, and I know it in Machen, Arthur Machen's Great God Pan and The White People. Another connection that I was thinking of, it would be really interesting to take this novel and read it alongside of another post-World War II dystopia, or alongside of a novel like, oh, Ursula Le Guin, Wrinkle in Time.
Madeline Lingle.
Sorry, Madeline Lingle. I get Ursula Le Guin and Madeline Lingle crossed in my head all the time. Anyway, Wrinkle in Time, I feel owes a lot to that Hideous Strength. It's almost now that I'm kind of looking back at my memories of it, it almost feels like a YA novel version of that Hideous Strength. So there's that. I'm not actually going to recommend that you go read Frank Peretti demon conspiracy novels, but you can definitely see how they grow out of something like this. That yeah. Hideous Strength is the sort of thing that they're trying to be.
I mean, it's okay to have fond memories of Frank Peretti books.
Yes. Keep it there. Keep it there. That golden haze of adolescent memory is good for it. But otherwise, there's just a lot there's so much that Lewis is doing in here that branches into conspiracy literature, government conspiracies, alien conspiracies, right? Like this is just the David Icke reptilian stuff. And now I'm just going to become Danny Anderson for a second. But that whole idea of world systems being manipulated by these alien intelligences for their own ends, that are not for the good of the humane. There's so much that's going on here that connects to a lot of stuff that's so hot right now. I think that Hideous Strength deserves a revisit.
Well, I think that's a generous note for us to end on. Guys, thanks again so much for coming on the show. It's always great to have you on. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to the City of Man podcast, which is a part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please go to ChristianHumanist.org, check out our podcast and other podcasts on the network. Please leave us a review on iTunes to help others find the show. And like our Facebook page at facebook.com/City of Man Podcast. You can also get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Edward Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of high...